Hello everyone, my name is Tom Wagenmakers.
My name is Julia Meyer.
I am a lecturer in international relations at the University of Groningen.
And I'm a master's student at the University of Groningen, currently studying Euroculture.
Thank you very much, Julia, for helping us out today. And today we would like to welcome you to our 13th episode of our podcast, which will focus on the Armenian-Azerbaijani peace talks. And our guest for today is Rusif Huseynov. He is the chairman of the Topçubasov Center in Baku, which is a think tank dedicated to research on international affairs. Rusif has a fellowship at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and his research interests are in peace and conflict studies, separatist movements, identity, Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, the Middle East, and Central Asia. Please let me know if I forgot anything. But I think that Rusif is the perfect guest to discuss the recent developments between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Rusif, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom and Julia. Delighted to be a guest in your great podcast show. Yeah, the introduction is more than perfect. Thank you very much.
All right. Awesome. I think then we can go to the first question. Julia,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, as Tom already mentioned, our podcast topic today are the recent Armenian-Azerbaijani peace talks and Armenian-Azerbaijani relations in general. So I think it's only fitting for you as our guest to give us a short introduction and maybe concisely explain to us and our listeners what exactly is going on at the moment and why is it important.
We are talking about the broad Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict, the nucleus of which is the issue of Karabakh. It is a region in the very heart of Azerbaijan, where both Armenian and Azerbaijani communities coexisted peacefully for centuries. But the current conflict, the so-called Nagorno-Karabakh conflict, is dating back to the early 20th century. After the collapse of the Tsarist Empire, both Armenia and Azerbaijan became independent in 1918, and the dispute over the region, which was part of Azerbaijan, arose. Although the Republic of Armenia put forth some territorial claims against Azerbaijan, the Council of the Karabakh Armenians accepted Azerbaijan's sovereignty in 1990. After the Bolshevik takeover in the 20s of both Armenia and Azerbaijan, the Soviets kept Karabakh inside of Azerbaijan. Toward the demise of the Soviet Union, late 80s, early 90s, the so-called unification movement arose in Armenia, and it was designed to unify or incorporate Karabakh into Azerbaijan. The Soviet leadership tried to somehow regulate this issue, but the Red Empire was crumbling. It did not have sufficient resources. It did not have enough time to somehow to deal with these complicated issues. Once the USSR collapsed, the inter-ethnic clashes, which were already happening in Karabakh between the local Armenians and Azerbaijanis, turned into a full-fledged war, but this time between two newly independent states, Armenia and Azerbaijan. Due to unpreparedness of Azerbaijan's armed forces, also due to the infighting of various clans and groupings for power in Baku, the Azerbaijani side failed miserably in the first war, the first phase of the Karabakh conflict, which we call the First Karabakh War. It lasted for a few years until 1994, during which the Armenian side not only occupied the so-called Nagorno-Karabakh Autonomous Oblast, and self-governing territory the Soviets created for the local Armenians in the mountainous part of the region, but also seven surrounding provinces, predominantly inhabited by local Azerbaijanis. So 20% of Azerbaijan's territory, both Nagorno-Karabakh and surrounding districts, were occupied by the Armenian forces. Some 600,000-700,000 Azerbaijanis were driven out of their homes in Karabakh, plus another 200,000-300,000 ethnic Azerbaijanis were also driven out of present-day Republic of Armenia. So a total 1 million Azerbaijanis were displaced as a result of this conflict. The first war ended in 1994. For the next 2.5 decades, the parties engaged in negotiations accompanied by occasional flare-ups, which culminated in the 2020 Second Karabakh War. As a result of this recent war, Azerbaijan emerged victorious. It managed to liberate formerly occupied territories. And there is now this thin strip of land in the mountainous part of Karabakh, which is now under the protection of the Russian forces until 2025. But right now there are talks about how to reintegrate the remaining part of the Armenian community of Karabakh into Azerbaijan.
All right. I think that's a very good overview. So I think what is important to understand is what you said about that Karabakh is also internationally recognized as being inside Azerbaijan, right? I think that's
correct, Tom. When Azerbaijan was admitted to the United Nations in 1992, it was accepted with Karabakh. The subsequent UN Security Council resolutions, at least four of them, I'm not even counting UN General Assembly resolutions, they all recognize Karabakh as part of Azerbaijan and called for Armenian forces to withdraw from the occupied territories, but they were never implemented. But in any case, almost all the countries in the world and all the institutions unambiguously admitted Karabakh as part of the Republic of Azerbaijan.
Now, I think that is important to understand also the stance of the international community during the 2020 war, right? Because we saw that the conflict happened, but then everyone's like, well, it's complicated. Let's put it that way.
Of course. I understand this concern of international organizations or other countries about the security of the people who are currently dwelling in the region. I also share this concern, but at the same time, we have to make it clearer for the unprepared audience. Let's quickly draw a parallel between the current conflict in Ukraine and the case of Azerbaijan. Just imagine we also had our own Donbass, which was Karabakh. The Donbass was backed by a kin state, the Russian Federation. In our case, Karabakh was supported by the Republic of Armenia. It was a secessionist movement plus foreign invasion.
It is important to also recognize what the people inside Karabakh want, right? Because that's what happened at the end of the Cold War, you said as well, like Armenia had this unifying movement, but then the people inside Karabakh also wanted this. But that's very complicated if it's officially recognized as being part of Azerbaijan. But sort of the war was fought. So as of now, is Armenia still occupying regions of Azerbaijan around Karabakh?
No, those regions were, as we call it, liberated, or reclaimed by the Azerbaijani side during the 2020 war. Right now, only this mountainous part, which is surrounded by these seven Azerbaijani districts, is remaining currently out of Azerbaijan's control. As a result of the November ceasefire deal, which ended the 2020 war, some 2,000 Russian troops were deployed in the area to protect local Armenians, but their mandate is expiring in 2025. So we have a couple of years to design, to elaborate proper reintegration mechanisms for the rest of Karabakh, reintegration into Azerbaijan.
Yeah, so that is where the current peace negotiations come in, right? So the surrounding area around Karabakh is now part of Azerbaijan again. So now the question is still on what to do with Karabakh itself. That's what the current peace deals are about, or do I see that wrong?
It's a bit more complicated than this, because right now we have two separate issues which were intermixed before the 2020 war. Prior to the war, the Republic of Armenia was the patron state or the security guarantor for the Armenian community in Karabakh. But since the Russians were deployed in the area, the Republic of Armenia is gradually losing its role of a guarantor. So we are now having two separate issues. Armenia-Azerbaijan normalization, which probably will no longer have this Karabakh issue. And a separate process is the Karabakh conflict. The peace deal, the current peace deal negotiations between Armenia and Azerbaijan, it has like several important points. One of them is a mutual recognition of territorial integrity that two countries recognizes that this is Armenian territory and this is Azerbaijan's territory, including Karabakh. There is still a big problem with undemarcated borders, which should be addressed. And another issue is the unblocking of transport corridors, which, according to some experts and politicians, will help to establish interdependence between these two countries in order to prevent further conflicts in the future. So we, if we have this peace deal with Armenia, then we will be able to deal with the Karabakh issue as Azerbaijan's internal matter.
Because the peace deal would include a recognition by Armenia of Karabakh as...
Absolutely.
All right, that makes sense. So do you think then that this peace deal, or these, well, we don't have a deal yet, but do you think that these peace talks are a game changer?
Yes, of course. Just imagine a century-old feud between two societies. Or more formally, this conflict is at least 30 years old. The current phase of the conflict, okay? We are not talking about the origins, which dating back to the early 20th century. This phase of the conflict has been lasting more than 3 decades. If we are able, if this generation is able to put an end to this conflict, to this bloodshed, it will be a game changer, not only for these two tiny countries, but for the entire region as well. We have been receiving some positive signals that some peace deal might be signed by the end of this year.
All right.
Unless some earthquake or tsunami, which is unlikely in South Caucasus, happens and creates another obstacle, then we are very hopeful that some document will be concluded at the end of the day.
All right. Thank you. So you already mentioned that this deal is important for the whole region, so also for all the players in the region. You mentioned Russia already. Julia, you have more on this, right?
Yeah, exactly. We do currently see some more movement from the European Union in the Caucasus when it comes to this conflict, especially in relation to the peace deal. So do you think it could be argued that the EU is sort of taking over the role of Russia in the region?
Yes. But in order to understand the context, it was the Russians who had dominated the Karabakh process for the past 10 years, until 2020. During and in the aftermath of the war, the Turks also penetrated into the region and challenged the Russian dominance. And now the Europeans, who were left out of the game during and in the immediate aftermath of the 2020 war, are now making a great comeback. Officially, we have 3 negotiation tracks. One is Moscow track, second Brussels, third Washington. But we have like several platforms where the top Armenian and Azerbaijan officials get together and discuss the peace deal and related issues. Okay, the Americans say their Washington track is somehow complementary for the first two. Like, let's stick with like 2 tracks, Moscow and Brussels. The Brussels platform for the Armenian-Azerbaijani negotiations has been rather effective and more fruitful because we see how interested the European side is for the eventual and long-lasting peace in this region, unlike the Russians. As you just mentioned, the European Union, like or the, in general, the European community, would like to see finally a stable region in the direct neighborhood. This region, just like the Balkans, has always been a gunpowder for the entire Eurasia. But finally, there is a historic chance to put a conflict to an end. The European countries have their interest in Azerbaijan's oil and gas reserves, which are already helping to reduce the dependence on Russia. They also want to diminish Russia's influence by providing financial assistance to regional countries, by helping them strengthen their institutions. And by strengthening their institutions, of course, these countries will build more resilience towards assertive Russia in this region. So back to the question. Of course, Russia is still considering this region as her own backyard. So it will be very hard to challenge the Russians, and especially nowadays, when the Russians obviously are failing in Ukraine, they might seek like compensation elsewhere. Therefore, the more Western engagement or the more Turkish engagement will irritate the Russians more.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. So as we've seen with the so-called Normandy format with Russia and Ukraine, which I guess could be argued to have failed, keeping the situation in Ukraine in mind, would you say you're optimistic that the EU's moderation will work still, despite what you just said about Russia sort of having its own interests?
Yeah, of course, I understand this concern. There are some differences. The Normandy format included not only a regional country, Ukraine, but also Germany, France, and Russia. Here, in our case, the format is different. Russia is out. Let's say the biggest troublemaker is out of the process. And Germany and France are replaced by the EU, which is, of course, a very big and sometimes very inflexible bureaucratic machine. But ironically enough, it has been very flexible when it comes to the Armenia-Azerbaijan normalization. Speedy reaction to the issues happening on the ground. Quick decision making. And you mentioned Normandy format as an example of international failure. We also had our own Normandy format, which was called the OSCE Minsk Group, especially design body for the Karabakh talks. It operated for 2.5 decades, but no tangible result had been produced by this group. It was co-chaired by the United States, France, and Russia. During and after the 2020 war, we see the Minsk group also faded away. Of course, it's still existing on paper, but it had become so much dysfunctional that Azerbaijan, for instance, is no longer interested in this group, in its body, in this format. Therefore, we are trying to explore new tracks, such as Brussels track, the EU agencies. So hopefully the Western side will also learn from the past mistakes of the Normandy format and of the Minsk group, and will be able to provide a novel approach to the changing geopolitical realities.
I think it's really interesting that you mentioned that, because that's also my next question and I think last question for this EU section of the podcast, which is, how relevant do you think the meeting of the European geopolitical community, which recently took place in Prague, was in achieving these peace talks? I think there's been very prominent pictures of all the relevant heads of state coming together informally. So maybe you can give us your thoughts on that.
You mean the European political community?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to make any analysis or prognosis about the European political community. I think we still need some time in order to see how this platform will operate, because its goals are less clear for the member countries as well. But the first Congress of the European Political Community, which took place in Prague, gave us several interesting pictures, as you said. Both the Congress and its side meetings were remarkable because it provided a platform for Aliyev Pashinyan, Erdogan Pashinyan meetings. It also became a ground where several European leaders with Armenian and Azerbaijani officials decided about sending the EU monitoring mission, which is very crucial, especially after the latest escalation in September between the two belligerent parties. So we can, of course, give the credit to European political community because the decision, the negotiations happened. Negotiations happened there. Decisions were made during that gathering. But in general, I am more inclined to, you know, see the EU's role here, but in a broader picture. Okay, so if not the European political community, some other like high level summit or another conference would be used by the EU institutions or the member states in order to provide some mechanism for monitoring the undemarcated Armenia-Azerbaijan border. So to summarize what I just said, let's be hopeful about the European political community. But again, the member states, and especially the leaders who initiated this platform, should make it more understandable, should make its strategy more clear to outside experts in order to be able to judge its merits.
Yeah, I think it will definitely be very interesting to follow in the months and years to come. And I think that brings us to Russia.
Yes. Well, also a little bit about this European political community. I think it does. The timing is perfect, I think, because as Rusev mentioned, Russia is out of the negotiations, right? So the EU is, with this political community, presenting itself as a geopolitical player. And then that fits perfectly, I think.
It's very important. It's very important. For years, if not decades, the EU tried to keep its image as a normative power. But you can't fight Mr. Putin with like soft and liberal values. You have to have like this geopolitical and security dimension as well.
Yeah, but so turning to Russia, Russia's out of the deal, but Russia has been involved in the region, obviously. If I remember correctly, the last ceasefire was brokered by Russia and the EU tried to be involved, but it was left out. So now Russia is left out. How come?
Well, as I said, we had this the so-called OSCE Minsk group, which was is still formally in charge of the Karabakh talks between Armenia and Azerbaijan. But having sidelined other co-chairs, namely the US and France, Russia had dominated the whole process for the past 10, 12 years. But now, after the 2020 war, the Russians also found themselves in more or less an advantageous position because they were able to send their own so-called peacekeeping mission to the ground. Finally, they got the boots on the ground, which they had desired for more than two decades. Now, obviously, the Russians are distracted now. They are stuck in the Ukrainian swamps. So probably it does not have sufficient resources to deal with the processes which are happening, say, in South Caucasus or Central Asia. But of course, it is still an imperial power. It's still having this ambition to be inside of the developments, geopolitical developments, which are happening in what they call the near abroad. So, although distracted now, they still want to be part of any deals which are happening in South Caucasus. Any attempts of Brussels or Washington or Western institutions in general to bring Armenia and Azerbaijan closer, to finally reach some sort of peace deal, instantly generate jealousy and backlash by Moscow. If you check the recent statements of the Russian MFA regarding the like steps of the Western institutions, the EU monitoring mission, for instance, OSCE delegation both deployed in the region along the Armenia-Azerbaijan border, we see how the Russian side is criticizing the West, condemning the West for allegedly interfering in regional affairs. So it's obvious that the Russians are not very happy about this situation. So maybe they have their own vision of the region, which was reflected in their December ultimatum to NATO, if you remember that, 2 months before the invasion of Ukraine. They shared their own vision about Eurasia, about dividing the continent again through the Iron Curtain, according to which South Caucasus should be an exclusive zone of Russian interest. So therefore, the penetration of Turkey, for instance, or the EU or the United States can never be welcomed by the Kremlin. So what was your question again? I'm sorry, I spoke too much.
Yeah, no, initially the question was like, why are the Russians left out? But I think what you mentioned about the boots on the ground is interesting because these boots on the ground are still there. So that does ensure that any deal will have to include some kind of Russian agreement, right?
Yeah, that's true. But they don't have like huge military base, just 2,000 troops in Karabakh. Igumri is a different story. In Karabakh, we accept that these soldiers are on Azerbaijani soil, therefore we cannot like ignore the Russian factor. At the same time, we realize know, they are failing in Ukraine. So at the same time, let me tell you that instinctively, people both in Armenia and Azerbaijan, society, experts community, and the elites, we all do realize that the Russians are not interested in solving the conflict. Therefore, there is some trust, some leaning towards the so-called Brussels threat, because we realize the European agencies, these bureaucrats, they want to see some tangible results. They want to see a stable and peaceful and prosperous region in their direct neighborhood. But this is not the case with the Russians. Both the Armenians and Azerbaijanis understand, given our past experience, that the Russians use this conflict in order to continue their leverage on both belligerent parties. Therefore, they would be interested in protracting this current situation. You can call it also no war, no peace situation, as long as possible, in order to have the boots on the ground, in order to impose their own will, both on Baku and Yerevan, in order to, you know, get some deals or get some agreements to bypass sanctions and all this stuff. Therefore, right now, we can claim the Russians are out of the game to some extent, but they are still influential in this region.
All right, thank you. Then I think we can turn to Turkey.
Yes, maybe just briefly, since I think we're nearing the end of the podcast already. How is Turkey related to the peace deal that is currently being negotiated?
Turkey is a regional power and become more relevant, especially during and after the war. It became the first Western and NATO state which was able to enter the so-called Russian backyard geopolitically, militarily, and assertively. The Armenian-Turkish relations are also dependent on and related to Armenian-Azerbaijan relations. Because although Turkey recognized Armenia's independence in 1991, it was the first country to have recognized Armenia's independence after the Soviet Union's collapse. It had to freeze the diplomatic relations and close the borders because of the occupation of Azerbaijani territories by Armenia. So if we see some positive signals about Armenia-Azerbaijan rapprochement, then we can also speculate about the normalization between Armenia and Turkey. Turkey is also interested in, you know, establishing the so-called Middle Corridor, a big land bridge designed to connect East and West, especially against the backdrop of the war in Ukraine, because like many traditional supply lines passing through Russia are disrupted now. Many companies, they are seeking alternative routes. And the alternative route can go through Turkey, Armenia, Azerbaijan. Therefore, one of the priority issues for these three countries is to finally solve their disagreements, move forward with normalization, and unblock transport, regional transport and communication lines. It will help us establish interdependence between formerly warring parties and also help this region become a transport hub for East and West and even North and South. But in my opinion, Armenia needs this normalization and these unblocked transport routes more than Azerbaijan and Turkey, because it's a tiny and landlocked country. It needs an access to the world markets, needs an access to the world oceans. We have already established our own transport infrastructure through Georgia, which is bypassing Armenia. So I believe it will be more beneficial for all three countries, especially for Armenia, if we are able to move on with some tangible regional projects.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think that is also kind of a nice cliffhanger to end on, because of course the whole peace deal that should be coming is also dependent on the willingness of Armenia to actually accept Artsakh Karabakh, right? Well, Armenians call it Artsakh of Karabakh becoming a part of Azerbaijan. And I think that's domestically in Armenia the biggest issue right now, that Pashinyan maybe wants to sign a deal, but then domestically there's a lot of infighting about this. So, but yeah, thank you very much, Rusif. I think we have given a very nice background to these peace talks, and I think, yeah, it's very relevant as well. And thank you very much.
Thank you for hosting me. it was a pleasure to speak with you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for being here with us, spending the morning with us.
Thank you, Julia. Yeah, take care.